produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written and produced by Sherry Lund and Brian DeShazer. Brian also produced the feature with the NLGJA's Ken Miguel. City Lauper and Garbage performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks David Hunt of Raleigh, North Carolina, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, U.S.
And good afternoon. It's a few seconds after 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, let me get my sheet handy here. In the first hour, you'll hear the Page Lecture, this year's the Page Lecture. It was called Alive on the Page, How an Editor Reads, and it featured Lynn Henry, Editor-in-Chief at NOMF, Canada, and publishing director of Alchemy by Knopf. The series is organized, the lecture series, by Queen's University Department of English Literature and Creative Writing, and the lecture was held in Watson Hall in October 21st. This 80-minute-plus event will air into the second hour uninterrupted. I might mention this series started, I believe, was in 2012. And in the second hour and following the remainder of this year's The Page Lecture, I'll share some upcoming events, current calls, and also maybe a bit of music. And one thing I will mention that I do mention at the top of each hour is that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety for just to honor the integrity of both the author and the piece. And usually I would announce at the end of each hour, but because I'm not going to interrupt this reading at the end of this hour, just a reminder that all shows are, I do upload all shows to my blog space each week, my personal blog space for the show at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com later in the evening, usually about 7 o'clock. And it will remain there for 3 years. Another thing I'd like to do just briefly, because it just started, and we'll take a, I will talk about it probably a bit more in the second hour today. And it's this, beginning last, well, was it Saturday? Yeah, November 1st, CFRC began its annual funding drive, and it will run until December 31st. What I'm going to do, since I won't be interrupting this hour, I would like to just do a brief clip just to kind of plug it. So let's do that, and I'll be right back.
CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt or sweet, sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. Thank you for your support.
And you can find everything about the funding drive that you need to know, including, well, just everything, really. And then about the station, just go to our website, www.cfrc.ca. Click on a sublink up on the top of the page that says donate. We make it easy these days. So there you go. I do want to give a shout out. I believe it was last weekend. At least some point shortly after the funding drive began, David from Ottawa donated and plugged, said how much he loved the radio station and said he liked the show. So I give him my thanks and the station's thanks for his donation. And let's go ahead now and move into the heart of today's show. In it again, you'll hear this year's page lecture, Live on the Page, How an Editor Reads. Yeah, featuring again Lynn Henry, Editor-in-Chief at Knopf Canada and Publishing Director of Alchemy by Knopf. The series and this event is organized by Queen's University Department of English, Literature, and Creative Writing. The lecture was held in Watson Hall on October 21st. Again, I will air this uninterrupted, so you won't hear my voice again until almost midway through the second hour today. So here we go. It was a wonderful lecture. I hope you enjoy it.
Okay. I think we're going to start. I'm Helen Humphries. I'm Acting Director of Creative Writing. And I'm going to start with the land acknowledgement and then outline how this afternoon is going to unfold. We acknowledge that Queens is situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and Huron-Wendat peoples. We are grateful to come together here to share our stories on this land where Indigenous storytellers have shared and continue to share their stories. We recognize and celebrate the ongoing power of story in this place. So welcome. Today, how this will go is I'm going to give a little background on the page lecture. I'm going to introduce Kai Kello, who is going to introduce the inimitable Lynn Henry. Lynn will talk, and then there'll be a Q&A portion after that. And then at the end, there will be a reception. Food will come in at a certain point after around 4 o'clock, and then there's a cash bar over there, and you can talk to them in the middle to hang out. Okay, so clear? Yes, I hope so. Since 2011, the English Department's annual page lectures have brought renowned Canadian writers to Queens to reflect on artistic craft through the evocative prompt of the page. The series honors Joanne Page, known for her creation of both literary and visual art, and for her tireless support of local artists. The series is supported by Joanne's family and friends and by the Department of English. All right, I'm going to introduce Kai Kello. Kai Kello is a poet, fiction writer, and sound performer. His work emerges at a crossroads of social engagement and formal experiment. His long poem, Magnetic Equator, McClendon Stewart 2019, is the 2020 Griffin Poetry Prize winner, won the 2020 Griffin Poetry Prize. His short story collection, Dominoes at the Crossroads, Vehicle Press 2020, was adapted for the stage. He is a vocalist for Fear, an avant jazz nonet whose last record appeared in 2024 on the Constellation label. His forthcoming long poem, Interposition, will be published with McClendon Stewart in 2026. Please welcome Kai.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Watson, and welcome to the Page Lecture. It's nice to see all of you. Some familiar faces, some people I haven't seen that much of this semester, so hopefully we'll be able to catch up a bit afterwards. This is going to talk a little bit about popular culture and relate that to the page. In thinking about this year's Page Lecture and the prompt of the page, what first came to mind, strangely, was the 2002 movie Pollock. Does anyone remember that movie? Yeah. In which Ed Harris plays the troubled painter Jackson Pollock. About 30 minutes into the movie, we encounter a brief scene on which the narrative of American genius depends. The scene is one among several attempts to represent as much of the creative process as can be observed from outside the artist. To do this, the blank canvas is enlisted as a narrative device, perhaps even as a character foil. The year is 1943, and Peggy Guggenheim has commissioned Jackson Pollock, not yet established as a leading figure of abstract expressionism, to paint a large-scale canvas for the entryway to her Manhattan townhouse. We see Pollock in his studio, pacing in front of the canvas, very close, the dim light of a single bulb amplifying the shadow. Solemn music plays. Pollock appears to be sizing up the canvas in a battle of willpower, or perhaps a test of his taciturn masculinity. And then Pollock is diminished, crouched in a corner with his knees hugged to his chest, staring, forsaken, into the distance. The canvas is still blank. His wife, Lee Krasner, played by Marcia Gay Harden, then enters the studio and dutifully reminds him that reality exists, that time is ticking, that he hasn't painted anything in weeks, and that Peggy Guggenheim might withdraw the commission. He doesn't offer a verbal response. Instead, he shuts the door in her face and secures it with a chair. He must confront the canvas alone, in silence. This scene attempts the impossible, to externalize the internal process of artistic creation and to make us see what is not visible. But since this is for the camera, the mystery of creativity must be divulged for public consumption. Even if all the artifice of film can only suggest a thin romance of light and shadows, well, that romance will have to be sufficient. I consider this scene because although its subject is painting, the blank canvas could be substituted for the blank page, and Pollock's solitary pacing, smoking, posturing, and reduction to anguish could easily be the predicament of the writer, perhaps Anais Nin in the 1990 film Henry and June, played by Marcia de Medeiros. But I also consider this scene precisely because it cannot divulge the creative process, so it manufactures a popular romance instead. In this romance, we are urged to identify with the artist as he prepares to confront terra nullius and transform it with his industry. And as he prepares himself and us for this feat, we must also believe that in this moment, everything else is suspended, his relationship with his wife, for instance. There is only the man-god and terra nullius, the blank canvas, and this confrontation will define or will reproduce the familiar narrative. In this popular imagining, the blank canvas and the creative process exclude other realities. But why should this moment be isolated? Why should time and obligations to others be suspended in the moment of creativity? Or rather, can we imagine it differently? Moving apace with the demands and realities of the world, which do not stop. The creative process, although at times solitary, at times internal, takes place within a political, social, historical, and artistic context. It might be romanticized as conceiving a new world out of nothing, and then imposing this conception on that imaginary nothingness. But there is something too convenient, too brutal, and too vain about that conception. And this, I think, approaches the idea of the page, even the blank page, as a space that is already populated by existing voices, by lived realities, a space traversed by intergenerational narratives, a space beholden to existing economic, environmental, and geographic constraints, a space riven by political tensions, a space not of unbridled individual freedom, but of articulation within a community of voices, and a space into which a writer needs to bend in a listening, attentive posture if they wish to contribute their writing to that which already exists. This is what the movie could not show and what Pollock may have been considering. In that spirit of listening and collaboration, I'm very happy to welcome Lynn Henry, who will be responding to that fundamental provocation, what is the page? And who will explore the editor's role in reading what is and isn't on the page, and her role in defining the page for publication. Welcome, Lynn, to Queen's University for the Page Lecture. Lynn Henry is the editor-in-chief at Knopf Canada and the publishing director of Alchemy by Knopf, acquiring groundbreaking literary fiction and nonfiction. Books she has edited have won numerous accolades and prizes in Canada and internationally. Lynn works with acclaimed Canadian authors such as Madeline Tien, Miriam Taves, Sheila Hetty, Dion Brand, Rawi Haj, Christina Sharp, Kenesia Lubrin, Kate Harris, Maria Reva, Lisa Moore, Leanne Beta Samosek Simpson, Joshua Whitehead, and Otonia Okot-Bitek, alongside internationally celebrated writers as well, such as Sally Rooney, Judith Butler, Sunjeev Sahota, and Sarah Bakewell. So please welcome Lynn.
Kai, for that wonderful reflection, and I think there will actually be some notes in my presentation that dovetail with some of the things that you highlighted on your exploration of the page that, as we go along, that I hadn't expected, but I think will come together very nicely, and thank you for your very generous words. So, you can hear me, yes?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. A thesis. The book is the thing. No, wait. The book is the thing. But its life, its aliveness, happens on the page, throughout all the stages of its creation. Writing, editing, production, and reading, which is a kind of creation too. And the page is an invention for capturing, containing, and spooling out time, writing three of time's waves simultaneously. There's the time of the world in which one is reading, relentless, and although, as the physicists say, relative, broadly speaking, it is shared. There's the time, what we might, in the world of books, call pacing of the text on the page, specific to the piece. And there is the personal bubble, or let's call it the 6x9 or 5.5x8.25-inch rectangle of time where the reader's mind is in conversation with the writer's mind. Here, now, the shick of the page turning, the gesture of an arcing hand, the marker tucked in the spine of the page, maybe the transgressive turning down of a corner. Let's begin. The name of my talk is Alive on the Page, How an Editor Reads. And first, please allow me to thank all of you who are here today for coming to hear a stranger speak about books in the middle of what was a gorgeous fall day. And thank you to the people who had the idea that extending an invitation to me might not only be interesting, but a fitting way to honor the memory of Joanne Page, an artist and poet whose work I have, as a consequence, discovered with admiration and delight. Last night I got to hear even more about her from some of her friends, for which I'm grateful. So thank you to Joanne and to her family and loved ones, and especially Stephen Page, who has generously made this creative moment possible in this beautiful tribute. And then, of course, I must thank Helen Humphreys and the committee in the English and Creative Writing Department at Queen's who thought to ask me to deliver this year's talk. When Helen extended the invitation a few months ago, I immediately demurred. Surely it would be best to ask a writer, not me, who is only writer adjacent, a writer's shadow, a scribe at best. And I threw out some excellent names. Oh no, said Helen. Those are wonderful authors, but we want you. And she proceeded to, as I discovered later, somewhat lightly describe the task. You need to speak for a few minutes, she said, and it'll be a 5 hour. Maybe all I heard was, and there'll be a cocktail party. I'm in publishing, what can I say? So I said yes. But then, of course, when I started to prepare in earnest and looked into the matter more thoroughly, I realized that not only should I speak on the fascinating but serious topic of the page for quite a few minutes indeed, and not only are those words often bound into a lovely little printed volume where they have been in the past, but most heart-stopping of all, I was preceded in this task by a list of awe-inspiring literary luminaries, award-winning writers, as well as deep thinkers about literature and life as expressed on the page, including, and this above all, Helen somehow forgot to mention, Helen herself. So this is a roundabout way of saying thank you to Helen, who asked me, and thank you to the committee and the department who suggested asking me, and I'm honored to be in your company, and the inspiring company of every real writer and thinker who has contributed to this wonderful series, and by association in the company of Joanne Page herself. After accepting my mission, I looked more closely at the subject, and here too I confess I felt momentarily at a loss. The page, what could I possibly say about it? The book, sure. The author, definitely. The proposal, the process of publication, the world of publishing, absolutely. So much to say, perhaps too much. But the humble page, and then, like a fish that has spent its whole life in water, breathing water, surrounded by water, moving through water, practically being water, and is therefore or unaware of its essential element until the shock of being reeled into air, I understood the truth. I have spent the last 30-some years of my life thinking about, surrounded by, dreaming, both awake and asleep, of nothing but page upon page of paper and text. And when I say dreaming, I mean this metaphorically, yes, but also quite literally. Throughout my 20s, when I was just starting out in publishing, I would dream nightly that I was writing page after page after page of cursive. I could see my handwriting appear and would somehow be both the author and the reader of line after line on an endless scroll and never recall a word upon waking. And I believe I may have written several rather magical novels that way. Fortunately for me, and most of all the real writers I work with, as I moved deeper into my vocation as an editor, the urge to write vanishing novels each night faded like invisible ink. Meanwhile, in waking life, I began what now, in hindsight and with the prompt of this lecture, I understand to be my life not on, but alongside and devoted to the page. Again, I mean this literally. When I was in my early 20s, I happened to walk into a publishing house, a tiny, radical feminist press that employed three people, one of whom, newly and astonishingly the editor, was me. And it was at a particularly charged moment in the postmodern evolution of the form of the book. It was a moment of sudden change that dramatically affected the most alive part of the book, which, as I will attempt to show in a variety of ways, is indeed the page. This was 1990, thereabouts, and I was reasonably well-read, but I knew almost nothing about how a book, much less a page, was physically constructed. And in hindsight, I understand that I had walked through the blue wooden door of that small press. If I had walked through it, even 1 year later, I would not have this story to tell now. This small press in the Maritimes, where my family was from, was owned by a wiry and enormously energetic woman in her 50s, which seemed to me at the time an impossibly advanced age. And she had spent some years setting type in the old-fashioned way on a letterpress at Coach House Books in Toronto before decamping to the Wild East to set up her improbable feminist radical publishing house. I mentioned the owner's experience in bookmaking. She would say with pride that she had been a stripper, which was a particular stage in the old-fashioned letterpress printing process. I mentioned her experience because when I walked through the blue door, although I had not a clue that this was so, I was walking into a long history and tradition of knowing how to physically set brass type and physically bind a page to another page, something that was rare for my generation and really kind of unheard of for any generation after me in standard publishing. What I saw stepping through that door was a long room with well-trod honey-hued wooden floors, a row of three desks along one side, a bank of windows along the other, and tucked under the middle window where the daylight was brightest, a sturdy table with a large slanted surface on top of it. That surface was white, like a screen with a blank Word document might be today, and it glowed with ambient light from bulbs set into a box underneath. A gray metal ruler was embedded along its top and sides, pocked with a series of regular vertical black lines. On the desk to one side of this glowing rectangle rested a kind of handheld heated roller, a dish of orangey-yellow paste, which I learned was wax, a slim, sharp metal X-Acto knife, like a surgical instrument, I thought, and a small box of replacement blades. On the other side of the rectangle, a beautifully smooth, pristine white scroll rolled up neatly. This was my youthful introduction to the page before pages, by which I mean the physical page, briefly taking the shape of its ancient form of a scroll, before the soon-to-arrive, indeed, in that very moment, rushing towards us as we fit our blades into our X-Acto knives, computer program pages, to be followed by wave after wave of programs such as Word and Acrobat and Adobe InDesign and so on. But to return to the bone-white scroll in that soon-to-vanish lightbox-illuminated moment, I learned that when unrolled, the scroll contained lines of crisp type already set professionally in long columns followed by breaks like patches of untrod snow. And together, these columns and snowy pauses comprised the book we were to publish. And my job as editor of these pages on the scroll was indistinguishable, at least in that publishing house, in that quickly vanishing moment, from my job as designer. It so happens that the book in question was an astonishing collection of essays and poems that had just won a major international prize called the Casa de las Americas Prize. And the book I unspooled in amazement and awe leaning over that table was called She Tries Her Tongue, Her Silence Softly Breaks, by a writer who then went by Marlene Norbese Philip, but today is better known as M. Norbese, or simply Norbese. I'm sure many of you know. If any of you have read or seen the pages of that book, you will know how electric they are. The type breaks rules, escaping the cage of margins and leading and white space, sometimes even taking a provocative sideways position, or disruptively jutting into a rigid spine, or wandering in the opposite direction to hover along the precipitous outer edge of a page, just as the words it contains do. I will confess to you that, in hindsight, I can see I knew so little back then about editing, or about designing a page, or indeed, I suppose, about life, which is important in this context, because I was tasked at that very early age, not only with creating the physical form of this electric book, but with understanding it and articulating that understanding in a conversation with the author, who certainly knew much more about all of these things than I did then, and articulating it with others who stoked the fires that turned the commercial engine of the publishing world, by which I mean colleagues in sales and marketing and publicity. Still, somehow, I did intuitively grasp the sheer astonishment and audacity of that work, even if I was learning, in fact, still am learning, how to read and understand its meanings. And I marvel now, from this remove of decades, at what I was allowed to do then, unfurling and then setting that roll of burning words, which were so much more than words. I marvel that I was not only allowed to do it, but that I was casually charged with the task as if I had been doing it all my life. And in fact, you could say that precisely because I was charged with caring for that scroll of pages in that fleeting moment by an unconventional, impossible, soon-to-vanish, actually, publisher, I did end up taking on the task all of my life. Here, precisely, is the work I did on the table with the light box under the window in that improbable publishing house, now gone, 3 decades ago. I fired up the waxer. I clipped a standard sheet of 8.5 by 11 inch paper to the slanted surface on the table. I measured carefully and with a blue pencil marked little crosses, crop marks, at each of the 4 corners so that a smaller rectangle in the size of 6 by 9 could be discerned on the larger rectangle of the sheet. I scooped a measure of wax, and I wedged it into a little compartment into the waxer's rolling head, trying not to let the residue cling to my fingers. I fit a new razor-sharp blade to the little metal X-Acto knife with its crosshatch grooves for holding tight. I placed and clipped the top of the scroll on a mightily scored green cutting board and gingerly unrolled it partway to where I spotted a page number, where I clipped the scroll again partway along the side. Then I placed the knife along the left-hand edge, and in one quick movement, I cut in a straight line, releasing what was now a single page and letting the rest of the scroll curl back in on itself. I turned that page over. I took up the waxer. I could tell it was ready by the distinct, not unpleasant, but certainly waxy, overheated smell, and ran the roller rapidly up and down its clear back, leaving little pockmarked orange tracks. While these tracks were still sticky and fresh, I swept the page over to the slanted surface and the waiting ordinary sheet of paper with its blue crop marks. I placed the waxy side down on top, making sure the beautiful bite of the black block of type so crisp on the photo-ready material of the scroll was centered properly inside the little crosses. Sometimes this required some adjusting, wiggling, or occasionally, and with sinking heart, peeling and pressing again. Then, when all was right, I took a little clean hard plastic roller and ran it over the page to make sure it stuck for good. That was the basic technique, repeated page after page, one by one. The unusual variation with that first book, though, with Norbese's book, was that some poems had words that curved down the page or ran sideways in a margin, and these outliers had been placed in columns on their own at the edge of the scroll. So then I had to cut them out painstakingly, one by one, dab them with hot wax, and place them with excruciating care in the steady hand I no longer have, as you can see, in exactly the right spot on the previously carved out page where they were to appear. At the end of this process, I had a bundle of curiously hard, mildly concave, bristling pages that were to be shot, so it was explained to me, at the printer before going on press. And heaven forbid that I, or the author, might want to change in proofing. This required generating a new mini-scroll with corrected type, going through the entire process with the wax and the X-Acto knife and the roller again, and the page being shot again, too. So let me reassure you here that this particular book, which I know continues to be read and studied, has been professionally and efficiently and cleanly typeset, probably with many corrections, many times, in many editions, since those days when a very green me stood over a light box by the window in the now-disappeared press. But I am forever grateful that its physical progress onto the page occurred in sync with the start of my professional immersion in decades of pages. Dynamic, dramatic, tactile, and miraculous, the stiff, waxed page came alive for me back then. And I lived for that in those days, less than a year before computers were carried across the threshold of the Impossible Press's blue door and many other doors of all other colors, and reinvented publishing. Here, I'm going to leave myself on that threshold, X-Acto knife in hand, sheet waxer in the other, about to meet a computer program called InDesign, and I'm going to retreat with you to the present. When thinking about how to structure this talk, I decided to look in two opposite directions. First, I turned to the past, thinking I would refresh my memory about the historical development of paper and print and type and books. And although I will, I promise, spare you the myriad details, there I quickly and happily lost myself for a period of some days, maybe some weeks, and with apologies to many anxious authors waiting for notes from me. I look at you, Helen, not because you're waiting, but you know what that's like. I lost myself among a tottering pile of pages, and I'll mention a small number of those books in a moment. But then I turned back to the present, and I regarded with fresh eyes the living book people of my acquaintance at Penguin Random House, who were, as usual, buzzing around the office where I work, or if they were writers, they were hovering over their computers at home or in coffee shops, doing their everyday work with words and paper and print and type in the general ongoing business of books. And I decided I would approach people in five distinct roles: a book designer, a print and production manager, a fellow editor, two authors, and one of our country's best readers. These last three names, which I will come to in a moment, some of you may know. And I asked them this question, which they all, not blinking an eye, kindly answered. What do you see when you look at the page of a book? How do you see a book page? So in both directions, past and present, I was curious about the same thing. What comprises the physical object of the page, and what does a page hold for she who holds it? Looking to history first, which again, you'll be relieved to hear, I will not recount here, despite the thrilling detail one might excavate. Oh, but wait, I hope you'll indulge me if I display three small gems from that deep mine of the past. First, and many of you will probably know this, the physical material used for pages ranges across an extraordinary variety of forms, from stone to silk to bamboo to papyrus to parchment, which I am sorry to say is another name for animal skin. It's quite true to say that many, many, many animals died in the production of pages and books. To wax over wood. The wax over wood is interesting because it's an object that eerily resembles today's ebook tablets. And then to, of course, more recently, trees. There's much to say about all of this, for the use of these materials was not a trivial matter. And indeed, the process whereby parchment or dried and trimmed animal skins pushed aside papyrus was kind of thrillingly revolutionary. But even today, the material of which books are made is certainly not trivial. An example from my own experience tells this tale. In the early 2000s, I was the editorial director at Rainbow Books in Vancouver when they were publishing the fourth Harry Potter book, which is when the author began, around the time that, sort of around the third and fourth book, where this author began to command extraordinary power over all aspects of the publishing process. And whatever one may think of this author in light of her use of her cultural power today, back then she leveraged her influence to demand that the pages of her book in Canada, and then first in Canada, but then eventually in all English language territories, not contain any pulp from old growth forest trees, something that required significant changes within the supply chain and production process within the printing and publishing industries. And these changes remain today. The second gem I mined from history is this. The mystery of when and how we made the leap from scrolls to what's called the codex. In other words, instead of a long roll of sheets pasted carefully to one another along a shared edge, we developed pages that could be bound, cut, and leafed through, remains even today a mystery, with various theories attached, the literary equivalent of the search to unlock DNA. But one dominant theory is that the solution likely lies on the exquisitely human level of the page held in the hand for reading. One wrapped recipient of a rolled packet of sequential letters was interrupted at some point in history or about to fall asleep, and wanting to mark their place, they made an accordion fold in that spot instead of placing a marker in the scroll. And from there, the quantum leap to folding pages and what we call folios and binding begins. And my third little gem is simply, you know, a literary aside that speaks to how the very language describing the physical form of the page once infused culture. When Herman Melville wrote Moby Dick, he decided to classify the whales he describes in that novel using the language of common page sizes. So the larger sperm whales, right whales, humpback whales, he called folios. And the medium-sized pilot whales, orcas, and narwhal were octavios, which is folding pages into eight. And smaller dolphin and porpoise were duodenisio whales, which are 12s. So they were terms he knew his readers would understand, but they were also metaphors that brought alive, with a hint of danger and seawater, the very pages the readers held in their hands. Stepping away quickly now from that maw of history, here's the main insight I gleaned the deeper I went. And it's one of those contradictory thoughts that's so plainly obvious it never occurred to me to think it, which is, simply put, that the page existed in many ways and forms and materials long before the book did. A very truncated history would go something like this. The page existed in papyrus sheets, interestingly, more or less the same size as the book page today, that were then glued together into scrolls to be unrolled in stages across the width of two hands held slightly apart, again, mirroring how we hold a book today, This was superseded by parchment squares of similar size, also made into scrolls, which were overtaken eventually by the codex or the bound-up pages we recognize today. And although we in publishing focus so much on the object of the book, or at least I certainly do in my daily life, it is the evolution of the page where the great intellectual, practical, philosophical, and commercial leaps happen that made the book possible. It is the page that we hold up, measure, design, cost out, bind up, and sell. The plainly obvious insight is that the page, historically and physically, truly is the mother of the book. Not, as perhaps we might think when we see those pages trimmed and growled and numbered between covers, the other way around. For those who want to investigate more, I recommend a book called The Book by Keith Houston, published by Norton. Actually, this is probably just the one book he might ever need to read about the subject, exceedingly detailed and comprehensive and very lively. There's also a book called Patience and Fortitude, a roving chronicle of book people, book places, and book culture by Nicholas Brisbane, published by HarperCollins. Patience and Fortitude, some of you may know, are the unofficial but widely used names for the marble lions that guard the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And then for, you know, reading and philosophical contrast, and an interaction with the page in the form of reading and rereading, there is the brilliant and revelatory Vivian Gornick, who I love to recommend in any situation, and her Unfinished Business, Notes of a Chronic Rereader from Picador, U.S. And she has some really interesting insights about one's emotional and intellectual attachment to certain pages in a book as reread through time. There are many, many other authors who have thought about and around this topic in many ways and forms. I mention these particular voices because they give a range of approaches and thinking, and combined, their chorus of perspective only reinforces for me the sense that the teeming life of a book, historically, physically, and philosophically, and creatively, happens on and through the object of the page. What exactly is this object, then, where such life can be sparked? This is where I'm going to bring in some of these other voices. Let me bring in from the five areas of the expertise I mentioned earlier. And first, I'm going to bring in Christy Hansen, who's our senior production manager for the imprint where I work, Knopf Canada, within Penguin Random. Christy says, when a production team in a publishing house looks at a page, we're looking for things that are designed, that our design and editorial teams are not. We're interested in measurements. We think about the life of a book over several different formats, hardcover, paperback, ebook. We think about the book and the different styles of printing it may encounter over its life, digital, offset, one color, basic black text, or full color. We think about the content of the page in relation to paper. Will our standard workhorse paper be a good fit, or does it call for smoother or heavier or glossier paper? We think about trim size. Does the size of the page work efficiently on a roll of paper? To work efficiently, it would minimize waste and cutoffs at the printer, maximize space, and be what she calls the most bang for our book. But will it work efficiently for the life of the book? We tend to adjust the trim size when we do a second format, for example, when we go from hardcover to paperback. So does the page lend itself to a shoot down? Does the trim work across all of our vendors? When thinking about scheduling for first prints or reprints, the page needs to work for all vendors. And when she talks about vendors, she means online as well as bookstores, to secure the best timing. Should the page have a rough front, which is sometimes called a deckle edge? Are there concerns about illustrative or design elements? And we look at margins. How long is the book? How much gutter space? Longer page counts won't open as widely, so you need more gutter space. Sliver volumes don't have the same concern. Is there a decent, what we call, thumb margin, a place for your thumb or your fingers to hold the page while reading so they won't get in the way of the words? Does it clear all the printer safety requirements? All elements need to sit back at least a quarter of an inch from the edge. And so on and so forth. Finally, she says, we look at scheduling. When I look at pages that have all the bells and whistles, full color throughout, stained edges, I can't help but think about timelines at our printers and what we need to do to make our schedule work, which means backing it up and getting early material all along the way, including from the author and from the editor. So production really comes down to numbers, and so do pages. And when I look at a page, what I ultimately see is dimensions and elements and costs and numbers. So that's my colleague introduction, and I can tell you I'm saved by her and the fact that she sees pages this way every single day. I was fascinated to find that when I asked this question of my editor colleague and friend, Siobhan Hearn, who works at Independent Press House of Anansi, her answer held echoes of Christie's, but from the point of view of the freelance editor she'd once been and the managing editor she'd been once too, when she was hiring freelancers. Siobhan says, in purely practical terms, a page is a unit of measure for words. 250 words, generally speaking, double-spaced on 8.5 by 11 page in 12-point courier. Although I have come to accept, with a sigh, Times New Roman, because resistance is futile. When I was a managing editor at the University Press, we pay editors by the page, which was the total word count of the document divided by 250. So that idea of 250 words a page. It's an imperfect, impossible system to try to standardize the cost of words. How long does it really take to read and edit those pages, much less write them? The word count per page is no measure of that, for sure, nor is it a measure of quality, but it seems in publishing is the best measure we have. Meanwhile, the book designer whose thoughts I sought out and whose answer I imagined might also be full of numbers and deadlines and processes waxed beautifully poetic. So this is what the book designer Kelly Hill, who's really one of our best designers in Canada. She's worked on Margaret Atwood's books, Miriam Tate's, I'm sure all of you have seen her book covers in bookstores. Kelly said, book designers are, of course, concerned with one page in particular, the first one, otherwise known as the cover. Its purpose is to visually represent all the pages that follow, or at the very least, provide a good first impression. As a designer, I'm given the author's name and the title, but beyond those words, how will I fill this rectangle? Do I look for imagery that reinforces the words of the title? Do I create tension with images? Do I offer the comfort of familiarity or provoke delight and discomfort with something new and weird? Or just try to make it undeniably beautiful? Am I hoping to satisfy an editor? She said in brackets, all week. Draw in a future reader? Yes. Or impress an author? In brackets, ultimately. That's a lot for 5.5 by 8.25 inches to answer to. But the visual solution for that very first page is, without exception, mined from the words of the pages that follow. What, you may well be asking now, of the creator of those words? What of the writer? Let's ask her. I will preface this author's quote by saying that my own deepest interactions with writers are often on the level of the page, looking at what is there and what is not there yet. At a certain stage, after big picture queries and musings have happened in an editorial letter and sometimes even a diagram or two, which I find are helpful for visualizing the larger structure, the author and I have a sufficiently revised manuscript, and we embark together on reading the page as both text and white space, having a conversation line by line where we try to understand what the page wants to be, what it wants to say, what it wants to withhold from saying, what it wants to echo, what it wants to oppose, what it wants to silence, and how exactly it wants to do all of those things. For me, this still sometimes takes the form of an actual markup in blue or black pen as opposed to electronic edit, depending on what the author prefers. If I use a pen, then I'll write in the margins and along the top and the bottom and sometimes the overlap of the sheet in conversation with the author's words. The page is simply the place where that conversation happens, and for me, it's alive in that way. For a long time, I didn't know if authors felt that too, but when I had done this work long enough that I had relationships stretching over years and books, I discovered that some of these writers, who were now like friends, felt emotion too when they received a packet of marked up pages from me. And the emotion was not, as you might worry, and I certainly did, despair or outrage or simply rage. Rather, they would tell me, looking at my really singular scribble in the margins, the emotion was, ah, there you are, at last. Yes, okay, let's get into it and talk, my friend. And the page became alive in this way for them too. So the writer to whom I asked the question is one I've worked with over the past decade, Miriam Taves. And here is her answer. So, yeah, I've really been trying to go deep inside myself to remember how I feel when I see the page of my work. I'm talking about seeing it on an actual book page. Not necessarily the book, but, you know, in those proofing typeset pages you send me in advance, showing how it will look in the actual book. And honestly, my feeling is a kind of somewhat sort of half-curious bystander indifference. Not total indifference. I mean, I want the pages in my book to look good just from a purely aesthetic point of view. But otherwise, it's like I've been living, feeling, agonizing, sweating, crying, laughing, panicking, dreading, all those things with the words, the text for so long, in the time before the actual writing, when I'm making notes, circling around my ideas, thoughts, it's a crime scene, and I'm going back for clues, then I'm running away as fast as I can from the horror of those thoughts, from the black hole of writing, or writer's block, or whatever it is, and then the actual writing, when it all somehow seems not bad, not what I intended it to. I work on changing that over and over and over, working with the words, rearranging, scrapping shit, adding shit, just full on and lengthy immersion, depths of hell, sweet moments of grace, God shining through the clouds, then gone again. So, after all of that, flattened on the floor, steamrolled, empty, satisfied, you could say, or at least with the knowledge that, yes, there it is, it's done, get it away from me. After all of that, then to have all of that somehow synthesized or contained or whatever onto the page of the book, and when I see it there, knowing everything that has come before on a cellular level, body, mind, is like a form of PTSD and more panic. And all that stuff exists for me in a different way or form. Oh, okay, I say to myself, that's it. There it is. What all that has amounted to, basically like pages. It's so nerve-wracking, but also I'm pleased in a small way that it's there, that these pages exist, and it's now a thing I can take and put away, store, having managed to extract that thing from myself in its terrifying, incoherent form, and having it end up neatly, solidly, right there on the page in a book. It's a relief, a strong feeling of relief, like it's over. I can start again, the whole process. Maybe it's a bit like being an older sibling being shown your new baby sister. It's like, oh, wow, I know I'm supposed to react to this moment with love and awe and joy. Working through my emotions for 9 months now, consciously or not consciously, of fear, rage, confusion, etc., being replaced, being disappeared. My parents are so very happy and overcome with joy and excitement about this new baby. And my role in it all, now I'm the big sister, I've got to be responsible and protective and put my own childish needs aside. I mean, I'm 4 years old. Anyhow, yeah. And here's the page. Love, Miriam. So, and now, finally, what of the reader? The reader I decided to ask is really, I guess you could say, a professional reader, now retired, but one of the best readers we have in this country. Some of you will know the CBC broadcaster, Eleanor Wachtel. So Eleanor said, I have long had a great deal of respect for the page. This is, I have to say, in contrast to Miriam here. I scarcely want my books to look as if they've been read, although in recent years I do allow myself to crack the spines. So I'm not someone who marks up the page, yet I'm curious to see and read the marginalia of known authors. And using post-its is very important to me when I'm engaged with a book in anticipation of a conversation. I think W.G. Sebald's innovation in adding uncaptioned black and white photographs to his very literary pages changed the idea of what a book page could be. The Emigrants was his first novel to be published in English translation, and although there are other examples of this practice, I think his was particularly influential. And then, of course, there's Canadian writer Kinesia Le Brun, whose recent award winner, Code Noir, includes 52 pages, one for each story in the book, corresponding to each of the 52 historical French codes that controlled the lives of enslaved people in the Caribbean. And these pages smudge out black and obscure and charcoal over words as part of telling its story. I'm easily drawn to small books with generous leading and margins. There's a certain coziness or intimacy to being able to hold it in one hand. But just as I was about to talk about how inviting Miriam Taves' latest book is, including the cover and end papers, I find I'm also captivated by Kiran Desai's 670-page luxuriousness in The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny. So that was Eleanor. I think fittingly, it is our good reader Eleanor's insight about the intimacy of a small book, how you hold the page open in your hands, that winds me back at last to the beginning of this talk. Remember our thesis. The book is the thing, but its life happens on the page throughout all the stages of its creation, writing, editing, production, and reading, which is a kind of creation too. And the purpose of the page is to capture, contain, spool out time, allowing a reader to ride three of time's waves simultaneously. There's the time of the greater world, in which one is reading time that is relentless and although relative, shared. There is the time of what we might in the world of books call pacing of the text on the page, specific to the piece. And there's the personal bubble, or let's call it 6x9 or 8.5x5.25 rectangle of time, where the reader's mind is in conversation with the writer's mind. If we now straighten and try to smooth out that corner of the page that we transgressively folded over at the beginning of this lecture, and if we take up a spread of pages to begin reading where we left off, we miraculously enter again the third kind of time. Time controlled by the reader. The type of life to be found on the page is in our reader's mind and in her hands, even if no other life nor any other unfolding of time is or can be. 2 centuries before the founding of the famous Library of Alexandria, with its thousands of scrolls tucked into their cylinders, which were placed into little cubby holes, perhaps around 420 BCE, the philosopher Socrates, yes, I'm going to Socrates, famously articulated this philosophical objection to writing in conversation with his student Phaedrus. Writing, Phaedrus, has this strange quality and is very like painting. For the creatures of painting stand like living beings, but if one asks them a question, they preserve a solemn silence. And so it is with written words. You might think they spoke as if they had intelligence, but if you question them, wishing to know about their sayings, they always say only one and the same thing. And every word is alike among those who understand and those who have no interest in it, and it knows not to whom to speak or not to speak. I came across this passage again recently in the context of thinking about scrolls and pages and books and time, and it stopped me for a beat. Socrates suggests that words are, in essence, simulacrums of life and thought, but not alive, not thoughtful at all. And who am I to, you know, argue with Socrates? Even so, let me briefly play the part of a sophist. It occurs to me that Socrates lived, like me, like all of us, in a particular moment. He is stuck in that moment, like I was stuck on the threshold of my first impossible publishing house, brandishing an X-Acto knife and a hot sheet wax roller, even as I welcomed the delivery guy bearing the cardboard box with a computer. The first pictorial reference we have to a papyrus scroll just precedes Socrates' birth in 470 BCE. What he did not have then, it is what I have and you have and generations in between he and us had and generations to come, we may hope, will have too. A sense of how, what is it we have? A sense of how to converse on the page through cumulative centuries of time and lives. And in this way, I and you through me right now may engage not with this person alive in the flesh, but with his thought, somehow still alive, or perhaps caught in amber in a particular moment we did not live through. Socrates' objection in the amber moment was more immediate. Writing had been recommended to him as a magic memory trick, whereby a person need not recall every detail of an everyday matter because the page in front of him could do that work, freeing space in mind and memory. Socrates famously believed this downloading of immediate memory was foolish and faulty and could lead to lapses and lies. An instinct that actually sounds very modern, not in reference to ancient scrolls, but to our contemporary compulsion of a similar name, and no accident there either, scrolling. But stuck here in our moment, our minds shaped for centuries by scrolls and pages, perhaps what we know that he could not is that through time, and precisely because his conversations and dialogues were captured by others and committed to the page, and then revisited and thought about and reprinted on another kind of page and argued over in another age, and then in another age again, each new page in time adding a layer, his thought has taken on a different kind of life. It is true that he cannot engage directly in dialogue with me or you, but he lived on the as yet not fully understood blue door threshold of another kind of dialogue, which is alive now in this very room, because he was and somehow still is alive on the page. The word page